3. Unlike countryside and college populations, the industrial working classes experienced no demographic earthquakes until in the 1980s they began to decline quite noticeably. This is surprising considering how much talk there was, even from the 1950s on, about a post-industrial society, considering how revolutionary indeed were the technical transformations of production, most of which economized, bypassed, or eliminated human labor, and considering how obviously the political parties and movements which based themselves on the working class were in crisis after 1970 or thereabouts. Yet the widespread impression that somehow the old industrial working class was dying out was statistically mistaken, at least on a global scale. With the one major exception of the USA, where the percentage of people employed in manufacturing began to decline from 1965, and very obviously after 1970, the industrial working classes remained pretty stable throughout the golden years, even in the old industrial countries, at about one-third of the occupied population. In fact, in 8 out of 21 OECD countries, the club of the most developed, it continued to rise between 1960 and 1980. Naturally, it rose in the newly industrialized parts of non-communist Europe and then remained stable until 1980, while in Japan it increased dramatically, remaining fairly stable in the 1970s and 1980s. In the communist countries undergoing rapid industrialization, notably in Eastern Europe, proletarians multiplied faster than ever, as indeed they did in those parts of the Third World which entered on their own industrialization: Brazil, Mexico, India, Korea, and others. In short, at the end of the golden years, there were certainly far more workers in the world in absolute figures, and almost certainly a higher proportion of manufacturing employees in the global population than ever before. With very few exceptions, such as Britain, Belgium, and the USA, in 1970, workers probably formed a larger proportion of the total occupied population than they had in the 1890s in all countries where vast mass socialist parties had suddenly emerged at the end of the 19th century on the basis of proletarian consciousness. Only in the 1980s and 1990s can we detect signs of a major contraction of the working class. The illusion of a collapsing working class was due to the shifts within it and within the process of production, rather than to demographic hemorrhage. The old industries of the 19th and early 20th centuries declined, and their very visibility in the past, when they had often symbolized industry as a whole, made their decline particularly dramatic. Coal miners, once counted in hundreds of thousands, in Britain even in millions, became less common than university graduates. The US steel industry now employed fewer people than McDonald's hamburger restaurants. Even when such traditional industries did not disappear, they shifted from old to new industrial countries. Textiles, clothing, and footwear migrated massively. The number of people employed in the textile and clothing industries within the German Federal Republic fell by more than half between 1960 and 1984. But in the early 1980s, for every 100 German workers, the German clothing industry employed 34 workers abroad. Even in 1966, it had been less than 3. Iron and steel and shipbuilding virtually disappeared from the lands of early industrialization, but surfaced in Brazil and Korea, in Spain, Poland, and Romania. Old industrial areas became rust belts, a term invented in the USA in the 1970s, or even entire countries identified with an earlier phase of industry, such as Great Britain, were largely deindustrialized, turning into living or dying museums of a vanished past, which entrepreneurs exploited with some success as tourist attractions. As the last coal mines disappeared from South Wales, where over 130,000 had earned their living as miners at the start of the Second World War, surviving elderly men descended into dead pits to demonstrate to tourist parties what they had once done down there in the eternal darkness. And even when new industries replaced old ones, they were not the same industries. Often enough, not in the same places, and more likely than not, differently structured. The jargon of the 1980s, which talked about post-Fordism, suggests as much. The huge mass production plant built around the conveyor belt, the city or region dominated by a single industry, as Detroit or Turin were by automobiles, the local working class united, welded together by residential segregation and workplace into a multi-headed unity, these seem to have been characteristics of the classic industrial era. It was an unrealistic image, but represented more than a symbolic truth. Where the old industrial structures flourished in the late 20th century, as in newly industrializing third world countries or socialist industrial economies caught in their deliberately Fordist time warp, the similarities to the interwar or even the pre-1914 Western industrial world were evident, even to the emergence of powerful labor organizations in great industrial centers based on big auto works, as in Sao Paulo, or shipyards, as in Gdansk. Just so, the United Auto Workers and Steel Workers Unions had emerged from the great strikes of 1937 in what is now the Rust Belt of the U.S. Middle West. Conversely, while the large mass production firm and the large plant survived into the 1990s, though automated and altered, the new industries were very different. The classic post-Fordist industrial regions, for instance the Veneto, Emilia-Romagna and Tuscany in north and central Italy, lacked the great industrial cities, the dominant firms, the huge plants. They were mosaics or networks of enterprises, ranging from the cottage workshop to the modest but high-tech manufactory, spread across town and country. How would the city of Bologna like it, its mayor was asked by one of the largest firms in Europe, if one of its major factories were to be sited there? The mayor politely fended off the suggestion. His city and region, prosperous, sophisticated, and, as it happens, communist, knew how to handle the economic and social situation of the new agro-industrial economy. Let Turin and Milan cope with the problems of their kinds of industrial city. Of course, eventually, and very plainly in the 1980s, the working classes visibly became the victims of the new technologies, especially the unskilled and semi-skilled men and women of the mass production lines, who could most easily be replaced by automated machinery. Or rather, as the great global boom decades of the 1950s and 1960s gave way to an era of world economic difficulties in the 1970s and 1980s, industry no longer expanded at the old rate which had swelled workforces, even as production became more labor-saving. The economic crises of the early 1980s recreated mass unemployment for the first time in 40 years, at all events in Europe. In some ill-advised countries, the crisis produced a veritable industrial holocaust. Britain lost 25% of its manufacturing industry in 1980 to 1984. Between 1973 and the late 1980s, the total number employed in manufacturing in the six old industrial countries of Europe fell by 7 million, or about a quarter, about half of which was lost between 1979 and 1983. By the late 1980s, as the working classes in the old industrial countries eroded and the new ones rose, the workforce employed in manufactures settled down at about a quarter of all civilian employment in all Western developed regions, except the USA, where by that time it was well below 20%. It was a long way from the old Marxist dream of populations gradually proletarianized by the development of industry until most people would be manual workers. Except in the rarest cases, of which Britain was the most notable, the industrial working class had always been a minority of the working population. Nevertheless, the apparent crisis of the working class and its movements, especially in the old industrial world, was patent long before there was, speaking globally, any question of a serious decline. It was a crisis not of the class, but of its consciousness. At the end of the 19th century, the very miscellaneous and far from homogeneous populations who earned their living in the developed countries by selling their manual labor for wages learned to see themselves as a single working class and to regard that fact as by far the most important thing about their situation as human beings in society. Or at least enough of them came to this conclusion to make parties and movements which appealed to them essentially as workers, as indicated by their very name, Labour Party, Parti Ouvrier and so on, into huge political forces within a matter of a few years. They were, of course, united not only by wages and getting their hands dirty at work. They belonged, overwhelmingly, to the poor and the economically insecure, for, though the essential pillars of labour movements were far from destitution or pauperism, what they expected and got from life was modest and well below what the middle classes expected. Indeed, the economy of consumer durables for the masses had passed them by everywhere before 1914, and everywhere except North America and Australasia between the wars. A British communist organiser, sent to the arms factories of wartime Coventry, as militant as they were prosperous, came back open-mouthed. "Do you realise," he told his London friends, myself among them, "that up there the comrades have cars?" They were united also by massive social segregation, by separate lifestyles or even clothing, and by the construction of life chances which separated them from the socially more mobile, if economically also hard-pressed, white-collar strata. Workers' children did not expect to go and rarely went to university. Most of them did not expect to go to school at all after the minimum school leaving age, usually 14. In the pre-war Netherlands, 4% of the 10 to 19-year-olds went to secondary schools beyond this age, and in democratic Sweden and Denmark, an even smaller proportion. Workers lived differently from others, with different expectations of life in different places. As one of the earliest of their British university-educated sons put it in the 1950s, when this segregation was still fairly obvious, "Such people have their own recognisable styles of housing. Their houses are usually rented, not owned." They were united, finally, by the central element of their life, collectivity, the domination of us over I. What gave labour movements and parties their original strength was the justified conviction of workers that people such as they could not improve their lot by individual action, but only by collective action, preferably through organisations, whether by mutual aid, striking, or voting. And conversely, that the numbers and peculiar situation of manual wage workers put collective action within their grasp. Where workers saw private escape routes from their class, as in the USA, their class consciousness, though far from absent, was less of a uniquely defining characteristic of their identity. But we dominated I, not only for instrumental reasons, but because, with the major and often tragic exception of the married working-class housewife imprisoned behind her four walls, working-class life had to be largely public because the private space was so inadequate. And even the housewife shared in the public life of market, street, and neighbouring parks. Children had to play on street or in parks. Young men and women had to dance and court outside. Men socialised in public houses. Until the radio, which transformed the life of the housebound working-class woman between the wars, and then only in a few favoured countries, all forms of entertainment beyond the private party had to be public, and in poorer countries, even television was, in its early years, something watched in some public space. From football match to political meeting or holiday outing, life was something experienced for most pleasurable purposes en masse. In most respects, this conscious working-class cohesiveness reached its peak in older developed countries at the end of the Second World War. During the golden decades, almost all elements of it were undermined. The combination of secular boom, full employment, and a society of genuine mass consumption utterly transformed the lives of working-class people in the developed countries and continued to transform it. By the standards of their parents, and indeed, if old enough, by their own memories, they were no longer poor. Lives immeasurably more prosperous than any non-Americans or non-Australians had ever expected were privatised by both money technology and the logic of the market. Television made it unnecessary to go to the football match, just as TV and videos have made it unnecessary to go to the cinema, or telephones to gossip with friends on the piazza or at the market. Trade unionists or party members who had once turned up for branch meetings or public political occasions because, among other things, they were also a form of diversion or entertainment, could now think of more attractive ways of spending their time, unless abnormally militant. Conversely, face-to-face contact ceased to be an effective form of electoral campaigning, although it continued out of tradition and in order to cheer up the increasingly untypical party activists. Prosperity and privatisation broke up what poverty and collectivity in the public space had welded together. It was not that workers became unrecognisable as such, although strangely, as we shall see, the new independent youth culture from the late 1950s on took its fashions in both clothes and music from the working class young. It was rather that some sort of affluence was now within the reach of most, and the difference between the owner of a Volkswagen Beetle and the owner of a Mercedes was far less than that between the owner of any car and the owner of no car, especially if the more expensive cars were, in theory, available on monthly instalments. Workers, especially in the last years of youth before marriage and household expenses dominated the budget, could now be luxury spenders, and the industrialization of the couture and beauty business from the 1960s on immediately responded. Between the top and the bottom end of the high-tech luxury markets which now developed, for example, between the most expensive Hasselblad camera and the cheapest Olympus or Nikon that produced results while conferring status, there was only a difference of degree. In any case, starting with television, entertainments hitherto only available as personal services to millionaires were now in the most modest of living rooms. In short, full employment and a consumer society aimed at a genuine mass market placed most of the working class in the old developed countries, at least for part of their lives, well above the threshold below which their fathers or they themselves had once lived, where income is primarily spent on basic necessities. Moreover, several significant developments widened the cracks between different sections of the working classes, though this did not become evident until the end of full employment during the economic crisis of the 1970s and 1980s, and until the pressure of neoliberalism on the welfare policies and corporatist systems of industrial relations, which had given substantial shelter to the weaker sections of the workers. For the top end of the working class, the skilled and supervisory, adjusted more easily to the era of modern high-tech production, and their position was such that they could actually benefit from a free market, even as their less favoured brothers lost ground. Thus, in Mrs. Thatcher's Britain, admittedly an extreme case, as government and union protection was dismantled, the bottom fifth of the workers actually became worse off compared to the rest of the workers than they had been a century earlier. And as the top 10% of workers, with gross earnings three times as high as those in the bottom tenth, congratulated themselves on their improvement, they were increasingly likely to reflect that, as national and local taxpayers, they were subsidising what came in the 1980s to be called by the sinister term the underclass, who lived on the public welfare system which they themselves could, they hoped, do without, except in emergencies. The old Victorian division between the respectable and the unrespectable poor revived, perhaps in a more embittered form, for in the glorious days of the global boom, when full employment seemed to take care of most of labour's material needs, welfare payments had been raised to generous levels, which, in the new days of mass welfare demands, seemed to enable an army of the unrespectable to live far better on welfare than the old Victorian pauper residuum. And far better than, in the opinion of hard-working taxpayers, they had a right to. The skilled and respectable thus found themselves, perhaps for the first time, potential supporters of the political right, all the more since the traditional labour and socialist organisations naturally remained committed to redistribution and welfare, especially as the numbers of those needing public protection grew. The Thatcher governments in Britain relied for their success essentially on the secession of skilled workers from labour. Desegregation, or rather a shift in segregation, promoted this crumbling of the labouring bloc. Thus the skilled and upwardly mobile moved out of the inner cities, especially as industries moved into periphery and country, leaving the old solid inner city and working class districts, or red belts, to be ghettoised or gentrified, while the new satellite towns or greenfield industries generated no single-class concentrations on the same scale. In the inner cities, public housing projects, once built for the solid core of the working class, indeed with a natural bias towards those able to pay rent regularly, now turned into settlements of the marginal, the socially problematic, and welfare-dependent. At the same time, mass migration brought a phenomenon hitherto confined, at least since the end of the Habsburg Empire, only to the USA and to a lesser extent France. Ethnic and racial diversification of the working class and its consequence, conflicts within it. The problem lay not so much in ethnic diversity, even though the immigration of people of a different colour, or, like North Africans in France, likely to be classified as such, brought out an always latent racism, even in countries that had been regarded as immune to it, such as Italy and Sweden. The weakening of traditional socialist labour movements made this easier, since these had been passionately opposed to such discrimination, and thus damped down the more antisocial expression of racist feelings within their constituency. However, leaving pure racism aside, traditionally, and even in the 19th century, labour migration had rarely led to that direct competition between different ethnic groups which divides working classes, since each particular group of migrants tended to find its own niche or niches in the economy, which it then colonised or even monopolised. Immigrant Jews in most Western countries moved en masse into the garment industry, but not into, say, motor manufacturing. To cite an even more specialised case, the staff of Indian restaurants in both London and New York, and no doubt wherever this form of Asian cultural expansion has reached outside the Indian subcontinent, was even in the 1990s primarily recruited from emigrants from one particular district of Bangladesh, Sylhet. Or else, immigrant groups found themselves concentrated in particular districts or plants or workshops or grades of the same industry, leaving the rest to others. In such a segmented labour market, to use the jargon term, solidarity between different ethnic groups of workers was easier to develop and maintain, since the groups did not compete, and variations in their conditions could not, or only rarely, be ascribed to the self-interest of other groups of workers. For a variety of reasons, among them the fact that immigration in post-war Western Europe was largely a state-sponsored response to labour shortage, the new immigrants entered the same labour market as the natives and with the same rights, except where they were officially segregated from them as a class of temporary and therefore inferior guest workers. Both cases generated tension. Men and women with formerly inferior rights hardly saw their interests as identical with people enjoying superior status. Conversely, French or British workers, even when they did not mind working side by side and on the same terms with Moroccans, West Indians, Portuguese or Turks, were by no means so ready to see foreigners promoted above them, especially those regarded as collectively inferior to the national born. Moreover, and for similar reasons, there were tensions between different groups of immigrants, even when all resented the natives' treatment of outsiders. In short, whereas in the period when classic labour parties and movements had been formed, all sections of the workers, unless divided by unusually insuperable national or religious barriers, could reasonably assume that the same policies, strategies and institutional changes would benefit each, this was no longer automatically the case. At the same time, both the changes in production, the emergence of the two-thirds society, and the changing and increasingly fuzzy frontier between what was manual and what was non-manual work diffused and dissolved the formerly clear outlines of the proletariat. 4. One major change which affected the working class, as well as most other parts of developed societies, was the strikingly greater part played in it by women, and notably a new and revolutionary phenomenon of married women. The change was indeed dramatic. In 1940, married women who lived with their husbands and worked for pay formed less than 14% of the total female population of the USA. In 1980, they formed over half. The percentage just about doubled between 1950 and 1970. That women entered the labour market in growing numbers was not, of course, new. From the end of the 19th century on, office work and shops and certain kinds of services, for example telephone exchanges and the caring professions, were powerfully feminised, and these tertiary occupations expanded and swelled at the relative and eventually absolute expense of both primary and secondary ones, that is to say agriculture and industry. In fact, this rise of the tertiary sector was one of the most striking tendencies of the 20th century. It is less easy to generalise about women in manufacturing industries. In the old industrial countries, the labour-intensive industries in which women had been characteristically concentrated, such as textiles and clothing, were on the decline. But so in the new Rust Belt regions and countries were the heavy and mechanical industries, with their overwhelmingly masculine, not to say macho composition, mines, iron and steel, shipbuilding, car and trucks manufacture. On the other hand, in newly developing countries and in the enclaves of manufacture developing in the Third World, labour-intensive industries thirsty for female labour, which was traditionally less well-paid and less rebellious than male hands, flourished. The share of women in the local workforce therefore rose, though the case of Mauritius, where it jumped from about 20% in the early 1970s to over 60% in the mid-1980s, is rather extreme. Whether it grew, but less than the service sector, or remained stable in the developed industrial countries depended on national circumstances. In practice, the distinction between women in manufacture and in the tertiary sector was not significant, since the bulk of them in both were in subaltern positions, and several of the feminized service occupations, notably those in public and social services, were strongly unionized. Women also, and in strikingly growing numbers, entered higher education, which was now the most obvious entrance gate to the senior professions. Immediately after the Second World War, they constituted between 15% and 30% of all students in most of the developed countries, except for Finland, a beacon of female emancipation, where they already formed about 43%. Even in 1960, nowhere in Europe and North America did they provide half of the students, though Bulgaria, another and less widely advertised pro-feminine country, already almost reached that figure. The socialist states were on the whole quicker to foster women's study. The GDR outdistanced the Federal Republic, but otherwise their feminist record was patchy. However, in 1980, half or more than half of all students were women in the USA, Canada, and six socialist countries headed by the GDR and Bulgaria. And in only four European countries did women by then constitute less than 40%, Greece, Switzerland, Turkey, and the UK. In a word, higher study was now as common among girls as among boys. The mass entry of married women, that is to say largely mothers, into the labour market and the striking expansion of higher education formed the background, at least in the typical developed Western countries, to the impressive revival of feminist movements from the 1960s on. Indeed, the women's movements are inexplicable without these developments. Since women in so many parts of Europe and North America had achieved the great aim of the vote and equal civic rights in the aftermath of the First World War and the Russian Revolution, feminist movements had moved out of the sunlight into the shadows, even where the triumph of fascist and reactionary regimes had not destroyed them. They remained in the shadows in spite of the victory of anti-fascism and, in Eastern Europe and parts of East Asia, revolution, which extended the rights won after 1917 to most countries that had not yet enjoyed them, most obviously by giving votes to the women of France and Italy in Western Europe, and indeed to women in all newly communist countries, in almost all former colonies, and in the first 10 post-war years in Latin America. Indeed, where elections were held at all, women everywhere in the world had acquired voting rights by the 1960s, except in some Islamic states and, rather curiously, in Switzerland. Yet these changes were neither achieved by feminist pressures, nor did they have any immediate notable repercussion on the situation of women, even in the relatively few countries where voting had political effects. However, from the 1960s, starting in the USA but spreading rapidly through the rich Western countries and beyond into the elites of educated women in the dependent world, but not initially into the heartlands of the socialist world, we find a striking revival of feminism. While these movements belonged essentially to the educated middle-class milieu, it is likely that in the 1970s, and especially the 1980s, a politically and ideologically less specific form of women's consciousness spread among the masses of the sex, which ideologists now insisted should be called a gender, far beyond anything achieved by the first wave of feminism. Indeed, women as a group now became a major political force, as they had not done before. The first and perhaps most striking example of this new gender consciousness was the revolt of the traditionally faithful women in Roman Catholic countries against unpopular doctrines of the Church, as shown notably in the Italian referenda in favour of divorce, 1974, and of more liberal abortion laws, 1981, and later in the election to the presidency of Pious Ireland of Mary Robinson, a woman lawyer very much associated with the liberalisation of the Catholic Moral Code, 1990. By the early 1990s, a striking divergence of political opinions between the sexes was recorded in a number of countries by public opinion surveys. No wonder that politicians began to court this new women's consciousness, especially on the left, where the decline of working-class consciousness deprived parties of some of their older constituencies. However, the very width of the new consciousness of femaleness and its interests makes simple explanations in terms of the changing role of women in the economy inadequate. In any case, what changed in the social revolution was not only the nature of women's own activities in society, but also the roles played by women or the conventional expectations of what those roles should be, and in particular, the assumptions about the public roles of women and their public prominence. For while major changes, such as the massive entry of married women into the labour market, might be expected to produce concomitant or consequential changes, they need not do so, as witness the USSR, where, after the initial utopian revolutionary aspirations of the 1920s had been abandoned, married women generally found themselves carrying the double load of old household responsibilities and new wage-earning responsibilities, without any change in relations between the sexes or in the public or private spheres. In any case, the reasons why women in general, and especially married women, plunged into paid work had no necessary connection with their view of women's social position and rights. It might be due to poverty, to employers' preference for female over male workers as being cheaper and more biddable, or simply to the growing number, especially in the dependent world, of female-headed families. The mass labour migration of men, as from the countryside into the cities of South Africa, or from parts of Africa and Asia into the Persian Gulf states, inevitably left the women to head the family economy at home. Nor should we forget the appalling and sex-discriminating killings of the Great Wars, which left post-1945 Russia with 5 women for every 3 men. Nonetheless, the signs of significant, even revolutionary, changes in women's expectations about themselves and the world's expectations about their place in society are undeniable. The new prominence of some women in politics was obvious, though it cannot be used in any way as a direct index of the situation of women as a whole in the countries concerned. After all, the percentage of women in the elected parliaments of macho Latin America, 11% in the 1980s, was considerably higher than the percentage of women in the equivalent assemblies of the demonstrably more emancipated North America. Again, a substantial proportion of the women who now, for the first time, found themselves heading states and governments in the dependent world did so through family inheritance. Indira Gandhi, India, 1966-1984, and Benazir Bhutto, Pakistan, 1988-1990, 1994, and Aung San Suu Kyi, who would have been chief of Burma but for the military veto, as daughters, Sirimavo Bandaranaike, Sri Lanka, 1960-1965, 1970-1977, and Corazon Aquino, Philippines, 1986-1992, and Isabel Perón, Argentina, 1974-1976, as widows. This was in itself no more revolutionary than the succession of Maria Theresa or Victoria to the throne of the Habsburg and British empires long before. Indeed, the contrast between the female rulers of such countries as India, Pakistan, and the Philippines, and the exceptionally depressed and oppressed state of women in their parts of the world, underlines their untypicality. And yet, before the Second World War, the succession of any woman to the leadership of any republic under any circumstances would have been regarded as politically unthinkable. After 1945, it became politically possible. Sirimavo Bandaranaike in Sri Lanka became the world's first woman premier in 1960, and by 1990, women were or had been heads of government in 16 states. In the 1990s, even the woman who had got to the top as a career politician was an accepted, if uncommon, part of the landscape, as Prime Minister in Israel, 1969, Iceland, 1980, Norway, 1981, not least in Great Britain, 1979, in Lithuania, 1990, and France, 1991, in the shape of Doi, accepted leader of the main socialist opposition party in the far-from-feminist Japan, 1986. The political world was indeed changing fast, even though the public recognition of women, if only as a political pressure group, still usually took the form, even in many of the most advanced countries, of symbolic or token representation on public bodies. However, it makes little sense to generalize globally about the role of women in the public sphere and the corresponding public aspirations of women's political movements. The dependent world, the developed world, and the socialist or ex-socialist world are only marginally comparable. In the Third World, as in Tsarist Russia, the great mass of lower class and poorly educated women remained outside the public sphere in the modern Western sense, though some of these countries developed, and some already had, a small stratum of exceptionally emancipated and advanced women, mainly wives, daughters, and other female kin of the established indigenous upper classes and bourgeoisies, analogous to the corresponding female intelligentsia and activists of Tsarist Russia. Such a stratum had existed in the Indian Empire even in colonial times, and seems to have emerged in several of the less rigorous Islamic countries, notably Egypt, Iran, Lebanon, and the Maghreb, until the rise of Muslim fundamentalism pushed women into obscurity again. For these emancipated minorities, a public space existed on the upper social levels of their own countries, where they could act and feel at home in much the same way as they or their opposite numbers could in Europe and North America, though probably they were slower to abandon the sexual conventions and traditional family obligations of their culture than Western women, or at least non-Catholic ones. In this respect, emancipated women in the westernized dependent countries were far more favorably situated than their sisters in, say, the non-socialist Far East, where the force of traditional roles and conventions to which even elite women had to conform was enormous and stifling. Educated Japanese or Korean women who found themselves in the emancipated West for a few years often dreaded the return to their own civilizations and to an as yet only marginally eroded sense of women's subordination. In the socialist world, the situation was paradoxical. Practically all women were in the paid labor force in Eastern Europe, or at least it contained almost as many women as men, 90%, a far higher proportion than anywhere else. Communism, as an ideology, had been passionately committed to women's equality and liberation in every sense, including the erotic, in spite of Lenin's own dislike of casual sexual promiscuity. However, both Krupskaya and Lenin were among the rare revolutionaries who specifically favoured the sharing of housework between the sexes. Moreover, the revolutionary movement, from the Narodniks through the Marxists, had welcomed women, especially intellectual ones, with exceptional warmth, and had provided exceptional scope for them, as was still evident in the 1970s when they were disproportionately represented in some of the left-wing terrorist movements. Yet, with rather rare exceptions, Rosa Luxemburg, Ruth Fischer, Anna Pauka, La Passionara, Federica Monsonet, they were not prominent in the first political ranks of their parties, or indeed at all, and in the new communist-governed states, they became even less visible. Indeed, women in leading political functions virtually disappeared. As we have seen, one or two countries, notably Bulgaria and the German Democratic Republic, clearly gave their women unusually good chances of public prominence, as indeed of higher education, yet on the whole, the public position of women in communist countries was not notably different from that in developed capitalist ones, and where it was, it did not necessarily bring advantages. When women streamed into a profession open to them, as in the USSR, where the medical profession became largely feminized in consequence, it lost status and income. As against Western feminists, most married Soviet women, long used to a lifetime of paid work, dreamed of the luxury of staying at home and doing only one job. Indeed, the original revolutionary dream of transforming the relations between the sexes and of altering the institutions and habits that embodied the old masculine domination generally ran into the sand, even where, as in the early years of the USSR, but not in general in the new European communist regimes after 1944, it was seriously pursued. In backward countries, and most communist regimes were established in such countries, it was blocked by the passive non-cooperation of traditional populations, who insisted that in practice, whatever the law said, women were treated as less than men. The heroic efforts at female emancipation were not, of course, in vain. To give women equal legal and political rights, to insist on their access to education and men's work and men's responsibilities, even to unveil them and allow them to come and go freely in public, are not small changes, as anyone can verify who compares women's predicament in countries where religious fundamentalism rules or is reimposed. Moreover, even in those communist countries where female reality lagged rather far behind theory, even at times when governments imposed a virtual moral counter-revolution, seeking to reinstall the family and women as basically childbearers, as in the USSR in the 1930s, the sheer freedom of personal choice available to them under the new system, including the freedom of sexual choice, was incomparably greater than it could have been before the new regime. Its real limits were not so much legal or conventional as material, like the shortage of devices for birth control, for which, as for other gynecological needs, the planned economy made only the faintest provision. Still, whatever the achievements and failures of the socialist world, it did not generate specifically feminist movements, and could indeed hardly have done so, given the virtual impossibility of any political initiatives not sponsored by state and party before the mid-1980s. However, it is unlikely that the issues which preoccupied feminist movements in the West would have found much echo in the communist states before then. Initially, these issues in the West, and notably in the USA, which pioneered the revival of feminism, were mainly concerned with problems affecting middle-class women, or in the form which chiefly affected them. This is fairly evident if we look at the occupations in the USA where feminist pressure achieved its major breakthrough, and which presumably reflect the concentration of its efforts. By 1981, women had not only virtually eliminated men from office and white-collar occupations, most of which were indeed subaltern though respectable, but they formed almost 50% of real estate agents and brokers, and almost 40% of bank officers and financial managers, and they had established a substantial, though still inadequate, presence in the intellectual professions, although the traditional professions of law and medicine still confined them to modest bridgeheads. But if 35% of college and university teachers, over a quarter of computer specialists, and 22% of those in the natural sciences were now women, the masculine monopolies of manual labour, skilled and unskilled, remained virtually undented. Only 2.7% of truck drivers, 1.6% of electricians, and 0.6% of automobile mechanics were female. Their resistance to the female influx was certainly no weaker than that of doctors and lawyers, who had made way for 14% of them, but it is not unreasonable to suppose that the pressure to conquer these bastions of masculinity was less. Even a cursory reading of the American pioneers of the new feminism in the 1960s suggests a distinct class perspective on women's problems. They were heavily concerned with the question how a woman could combine career or job with marriage and family, one which was central only to those who have this choice, which did not then exist for most of the world's women and for all the poor ones. They were, with entire justification, concerned with equality between men and women, a concept that became the chief tool for the legal and institutional advance of Western women, since the word sex was inserted into the American Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was originally intended to prohibit only racial discrimination. But equality, or rather equal treatment and equal opportunity, assumed that there are no significant differences between men and women, social or otherwise, and for most of the world's women, and especially the poor, it seemed obvious that part of the social inferiority of women was due to their difference as a sex from men and might therefore require sex-specific remedies. For instance, special provisions for pregnancy and maternity, or special protection against attacks by the physically stronger and more aggressive sex. US feminism was slow to address such vital interests of working-class women as maternity leave. A later phase of feminism did indeed learn to insist on gender difference as well as gender inequality, even though the use of a liberal ideology of abstract individualism and the tool of equal rights law was not readily compatible with the recognition that women were not and ought not necessarily to be like men and the other way round. Moreover, in the 1950s and 1960s, the very demand to break out of the domestic sphere into the paid labour market had a strong ideological charge among the prosperous, educated, middle-class married women which it did not have for others, for its motivations in these milieux were seldom economic. Among the poor, or those with tight budgets, married women went out to work after 1945 because, to put it crudely, children no longer did so. Child labour in the West had almost vanished, while on the contrary, the need to give children an education that would improve their prospects put a greater financial burden on their parents for longer than in the past. In short, as has been said, in the past children had worked so that their mothers could remain at home fulfilling domestic and reproductive responsibilities. Now, when families needed additional income, mothers worked instead of children. This could hardly have been possible without fewer children, even though a substantial mechanization of household chores, notably by means of the domestic washing machines, and the rise of prepared and ready-cooked foods also made it easier. But for married middle-class women whose husbands earned an income suitable to their status, going out to work rarely made much of an addition to the family income, if only because women were paid so much less than men in the jobs then available for them. It might make no significant net contribution to the family when enough paid help to look after household and children had to be hired, in the form of cleaners and, in Europe, au pair girls, to enable the woman to earn an outside income. If there was an incentive for married women to go outside the home in those circles, it was the demand for freedom and autonomy, for the married woman to be a person in her own right and not an appendage of husband and household, someone judged by the world as an individual and not a member of a species, just a housewife and mother. Income came into it not because it was needed, but because it was something that a woman could spend or save without asking her husband first. Of course, as two-income middle-class households became more common, family budgets were increasingly calculated in terms of two incomes. Indeed, as higher education for middle-class children became almost universal, and parents might have to make financial contributions to their offspring into their late 20s or even later, paid work for middle-class married women ceased to be primarily a declaration of independence and became what it had long been for the poor, a way of making ends meet. Nevertheless, the consciously emancipatory element in it did not disappear, as the growth of commuting marriages showed. For the costs, and not only the financial ones, of marriages in which each spouse worked in often widely distant locations were high, though the revolution in transport and communications made it increasingly common in professions such as the academic from the 1970s on. Yet, where once middle-class wives, though not children above a certain age, had almost automatically followed wherever husbands' new jobs took them, it now became almost unthinkable, at least in middle-class intellectual circles, to disrupt the woman's own career and her right to decide where she wanted to conduct it. At last, it seemed, men and women treated one another as equals in this respect. Nevertheless, in the developed countries of the world, middle-class feminism, or the movement of educated or intellectual women, broadened out into a sort of generic sense that the time for women's liberation, or at least women's self-assertion, had come. This was because the specific early middle-class feminism, though sometimes not directly relevant to the concerns of the rest of Western femininity, raised questions that concerned all. And these questions became urgent as the social upheaval we have sketched generated a profound and in many ways sudden moral and cultural revolution, a dramatic transformation of the conventions of social and personal behaviour. Women were crucial to this cultural revolution since it pivoted on and found expression in changes in the traditional family and household of which they had always been the central element. To this we must now turn.